This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will talk with Jim McCreary, former congressman from Shreveport, a Republican who is now advocating debt reduction, and we'll find out from Jim McCreary about how things are going on Capitol Hill in that regard. Also, gubernatorial biographer Leo Honeycutt on Bobby Jindal, the governor's essay for Politico, is talk of the nation. The governor using words like time to stop the bedwetting and time to start kicking around the other guys and time to put on our big boy pants. A bellicose Bobby Jindal. We'll talk with Leo Honeycutt about this new strategy from our governor, who's on a 64-parish tour. Also, nature photographer C.C. Lockwood on his conversion to the digital process. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757. Outside the area, it's Inkster Show at WRKF.org. In just a bit, we'll hear from Leo Honeycutt, the gubernatorial biographer of Edwin Washington Edwards, and he has some comments about our current governor, Bobby Jindal. We are slated to begin with former Congressman Jim McCreary. He served with distinction on Capitol Hill, the great state of Louisiana, from 1997 to 2009 as Congressman for the 4th District. And prior to that, he represented both the 4th and the 5th from 89 to 97, so about 20 years in Washington as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives for Jim McCreary. Good morning. Congressman, can you hear me? Kevin, I think we've got some problems with Congressman McCreary. Please check that line. 297-5633. Jim McCreary is now on the front lines of trying to address budget issues in Washington, and those, of course, have been quite prominent for some time since Bill Clinton left office in 2001. The deficit and the debt have been spiraling forward, upward, and both parties have addressed this, but have not done a whole lot to stop the bleeding, the red ink that is now permeating throughout Washington and ultimately affecting the rest of us. And hopefully we will make contact with Congressman McCreary, and I think we have. Congressman, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, how is it now being somewhat on the sidelines? I know you're still active, but you no longer have a vote. How is it in your new endeavors?
Well, Jim, it's as you know, it's a frustrating time in Washington, D.C. For members of Congress and either party, because things are just moving extremely slowly. It's hard to get anything substantial done. It's hard to get any cooperation from any quarter here these days. So, you know, I think I got out at a good time, to be perfectly frank. I would be climbing the walls if I were still there.
Well, there's a lot of division now between Democrats and Republicans. I guess there was from the moment you took office back in the late 80s, but it seems as though the division now is more intense than it has ever been.
I don't think there's any question about that. There's a lot of reasons for it, including the fact that districts around the country have been made either more red or more blue, that is, more Republican or more Democrat over the last three rounds of reapportionment, so that there's less reason now for members to compromise from a political standpoint, and there's more reason for members to simply try to appeal to the base of their respective parties. Members of Congress now are more concerned about a primary challenge than they are a general election challenge. In most districts around the country.
How does that affect the process as far as dealing with issues such as the debt that is first and foremost on the minds of many who are members of Congress?
It makes it more difficult to address those big issues like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, the drivers of the debt on the spending side, and it makes it more difficult because, as you know, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, those are very sensitive political issues, very difficult for elected officials to deal with because they know that if they make a vote that can be characterized as cutting Social Security or cutting Medicare, then they'll be pilloried in the next election. So it takes a bipartisan effort to do big changes in big programs like that. So our system of government was set up to move slowly. Our federal government system was set up to move slowly and deliberately, and that's good. But when partisanship is at an extreme high, then those barricades that the founding fathers put in place to slow the process down, to make it more deliberate, become much higher to get over. So it's more difficult now. There's no question about it.
What do you envision as far as where we're going from here? Is the debt going to get worse? Are we going to have these continuing deficits that are either approaching or exceeding $1 trillion?
Well, as you and your listeners know, the deficit has come down because of an increase in revenues. Many think that spike in revenues is a one-time thing due to some revenue coming in from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in repaying government loans to those entities, a one-time spike in tax revenues due to people moving income, particularly investment income, capital gains, dividends, into 2012 in anticipation of an increase in the tax rate on investment income in 2013. So that had the effect of increasing revenues coming in the first quarter of 2013. So even though we've got a decrease in the projected deficit now for 2013 down to about $640 billion, the expectation is that will only be a temporary dip, and next year the deficit will start to rise again. And long term, if you look 20, 30, 40 years down the road, we have the same exact problems in terms of a long-term debt, in terms of the unfunded liabilities of the federal government that we had last year and 10 years ago. That hasn't changed appreciably at all.
What can be done?
Well, the Fix the Debt campaign, on which I serve on the steering committee, is dedicated to trying to create an atmosphere around the country that allows policymakers, allows these elected officials in Washington to make the tough decisions that have to be made to correct the long-term picture, to get the debt on a downward path instead of an extreme upward path. And we're making some progress, I think. We have encouraged the leaders on both sides of the aisle up here and on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, the White House and Congress, to put aside their fundamental differences and try to find some common ground to move the ball forward up here. And we've had some success. As you know, the President and Speaker Boehner came close to an agreement a couple of years ago, the so-called big deal, when the supercommittee was working. They didn't quite get there, but they did find some common ground, and so we're hopeful that that can be revived at some point and that there can be a bipartisan agreement on some fundamental changes to those entitlement programs that I talked about, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, that will get the long-term debt picture in this country on a better path. So Fix the Debt campaign, I think, is a worthwhile exercise. People can go online and sign a petition urging their leaders to get together and solve this debt problem. I hope that more people will do that. But that's what I'm trying to do from outside. And of course, this is a voluntary thing mm-hmm. on my part. It's not, none of us is being paid to serve on the Fix the Debt campaign. So it's strictly pro bono. We're trying to do what we think is right for the country.
Kobe downtown writes, James Carville once suggested that passing a constitutional amendment prohibiting members of Congress from running for re-election unless a budget is passed each session with a deficit less than 3% of GDP. Does this idea have merit? What do you think?
The idea has merit. It's certainly important for members of Congress to do their jobs, and part of their job is to pass a budget. And so I certainly sympathize with the intent of the gentleman's suggestion. I think as a practical matter, it may not work just because of the way our system operates, but certainly members of Congress have a duty to fulfill the obligations of their job, but unfortunately, they have other ways to fulfill those obligations other than passing a budget. Right now, for example, the government is operating on a so-called continuing resolution, and that is in effect a temporary budget for the federal government. So it's a good idea in terms of the intent, but as a practical matter, I don't think that would work.
Jason writes, the CBO estimates indicate that federal spending as a percentage of GDP has been fairly flat since President Obama took office. What is your perception of President Obama's positions and actions regarding the debt?
Any president, Democrat or Republican, needs to be engaged with the legislative branch, with the Congress, in trying to solve the country's problems. Tax reform, I think, needs to be done, for example, to help solve this problem, the debt problem. In 1986, the last time the federal government undertook a massive overhaul of the tax code, President Reagan was very involved in that process, along with the Democratic leadership in Congress and the Republican leadership in Congress. All those parties had to work together, and even in 1986, with everybody on the same page, it just barely passed the Congress. Now, President Obama, unfortunately, has not been particularly engaged in the tax reform effort. And even though he has been engaged somewhat on the spending side, I think he needs to do more to try to bring the disparate elements in Washington together. The president is the only person really with the capacity to put his arms around both sides of the aisle and say, look, guys, we got to do this for the good of the country. And I think President Obama has not done enough to try to do that. And, of course, you get different views from different people, depending on where they stand, I guess. But that's my view, that the president needs to be more engaged and do more to bring the sides together.
Dan downtown. Dan, please be brief. You're on with Congressman McCreary.
Yes. Do you think Congress could better get things done if the members' focus was on the public good rather than their relationships with corporate interests that hire lobbyists once the congressmen leave?
Well, implied, I think, in your question is that members of Congress care more about their relationships with the corporate community and political action committees and lobbyists, and I disagree with the premise of your question. I think most members of Congress, in fact, the vast majority of members of Congress, do care about what's best for the country. That's why they ran for office. That's why they continue to serve and go through all the hassles and sacrifices that public officials have to make with their families and so forth. So I don't think that there's much merit to the contention that members of Congress are beholden to their corporate interests.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Leo Honeycutt coming in a few moments, and we'll be back to wrap it up with former Congressman Jim McCreary. He served right at two decades on Capitol Hill as a member of Congress with the Republican Party. We'll talk more in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with former Congressman Jim McCreary. He represented Shreveport and the surrounding area, much of north and central Louisiana, during his time in Congress in the 4th and 5th districts from 89 to 2009. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757, wherever you may be. KC in Central. KC, please be brief. You're on with Congressman McCreary.
Congressman, I keep hearing the same mantra chanted over and over again from the Republicans on how to fix the budget deficit. And it's, we have to cut entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. First of all, Social Security is not an entitlement program. We all pay into it. But it sounds, again, like here the solution is let's shift the burden of solving the problem from the rich down to the lower middle class and the poor people. You guys are going to absorb the hit. You're going to take a cut in whatever benefit programs you have, while the upper 5%, usually what they get is another tax cut. Any comment?
Congressman?
Yeah, sure. Look, if you examine the budget and you look at what's driving the debt in the out years, it's clear that it's Medicare, Medicaid primarily, and then Social Security to a lesser extent. And Social Security is indeed an entitlement program. Yes, you do pay into it, but the fact is if you're a certain age and you've paid into it a certain number of quarters, you're entitled to a set payment until you die. And then there are other entitlements within the Social Security system as well. But be that as it may, taxes just went up, as you know, for the top earners in the country as a result of the recent fiscal cliff deal. The tax on investment income, dividends, and capital gains just went up from 15% to 20%, plus the 3.8% increase in the tax rate on investment income as a part of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. So the caller is right that we've got to look at both sides of the ledger, taxes or revenue and spending. Some members were willing to do that. The Speaker and President Obama came close to an agreement a couple years ago to increase revenues and to cut spending. And that's going to be the ultimate answer to this. It can't be one-sided. It can't be all on the spending side or all on the revenue side. It's got to be a combination. Everybody knows that in order to get a bipartisan agreement. So I agree to that extent with the caller, but I don't agree that Republicans are looking at, you know, giving more to the rich and stealing from the poor. That's not what Republicans are all about. What we are all about is, I hope, fiscal responsibility, trying to solve the fiscal problems of the country, and we're all about trying to create an atmosphere that's conducive to economic growth and job creation.
This Fix the Debt campaign, Congressman, does it involve members of both parties?
Yes, it does. Absolutely.
So you have some Democrats and Republicans who are trying to do their best. But as you note, and we'll close with this, the partisan climate is so intense right now. That's, I would think, stands in the way from both parties coming to some sort of a consensus on this.
Oh, absolutely. It's very difficult. As we discussed before, the partisan atmosphere has heightened in Washington over the last few years, and that makes it more difficult.
So is that going to change, or is it going to be more of the same?
No, I think so. I think it will change. One of the reasons that the partisan atmosphere has gained over the last few years is we have so many new members of Congress. 2010 was a huge changeover in the membership of the House. 2012 continued that. So we have a lot of new members, and often when one is a new member of Congress, and I certainly remember when I was first elected, I thought I knew better than everybody else, and I knew exactly the right way to do things. But I learned over time that you have to listen to other people, and other people have ideas that are just as credible as yours, and they're entitled to them, so you have to deal with with people to get things done. These members will learn that over time, and so I think it will change back to an atmosphere that's more conducive to moving the ball forward.
If I remember right, you were elected in a special election to succeed Buddy Romer when he was elected governor, right?
That's correct. Buddy was elected governor in the fall of 1987. He was sworn in January of 88, which created an opening in his seat in the 4th Congressional District, and I ran in the special election to fill his unexpired term, and that special election was held in April of 1988.
And you beat Foster Campbell in a nail-biter.
That's correct.
And then beat him again, but that first one was razor tight, wasn't it?
1,300 votes, yes.
That's a close one. Well, thank you, Congressman. Always good to talk with you, and glad to do so again. Let's talk soon.
Okay, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you. 297-5633 is your number, and we switch gears and move a bit closer to home with Leo Honeycutt, the astute biographer of the most famous governor since Huey Long, maybe the most famous governor in the history of Louisiana, 4 terms, Edwin Washington Edwards.
Certainly had more time there than Huey.
He did, no doubt. Huey only had 1 term as governor.
That's right, really 2 years.
And he only had 7 years on the state or national scene, and what a seven years it was.
And then, of course, he made the mistake of announcing for the 1936 nomination for the presidency and died and was shot in September of 1935.
Well, he was 42 years old, the same age that Bobby Jindal is right now. He was a young man on his way, and Bobby Jindal quite likely will be running for president, but right now he's making a statewide tour. And we talked about this yesterday with Scott Wilfong and Trey Orso. Generally, people in public life in Louisiana don't go on statewide tours unless they're planning a statewide campaign. Could Bobby Jindal be running for the U.S. Senate against Mary Loretta Landrieu Snellings?
Yep.
Yes?
Yes, I think he's probably going to use this as a stopping-off point. He's going to get off the train in Louisiana and see if he can unseat her, because at this point in his career, I believe, if he's really going to try to make a run for the White House, he'll be in a stronger position from the U.S. Senate than he will be as governor of Louisiana.
Well, we're going to talk about this Politico piece the governor wrote earlier this week, which is getting both praise and criticism nationally. And in it, Bobby Jindal literally is flexing his muscles. And as we know, the governor is a diminutive man. And I'm reading an Esquire magazine piece in 2009, a bit from it, to give you an idea of how the national media views Bobby Jindal. Says Bobby Jindal's left hand was buried instinctively in the pants pocket of his navy blue suit, waist 28, one size up from the boys' department, a delicate physiognomy inherited along with his elfin ears and prominent nose from his mother Raj, a native of Punjab in northern India. Those words from Esquire in 2009, actually in 2008, published in October of 2008, the year that Bobby Jindal became governor of Louisiana. And the governor, I think he's a nice-looking fellow, but he's not a big man. But he, in the Politico piece, was talking the talk and basically saying, bring it on, or let's go on the offense. He said that twice. And Kevin Gallagher, our producer with the Golden Tones, like few others, has taken the governor's words. And I think, Kevin, let's do a little dramatic reading of Bobby Jindal's missive to the masses in Politico.
We've had enough. Yes, we just lost our second straight presidential election to Barack Obama. Yes, losing is painful and has consequences. Yes, when you lose, you make adjustments. Enough already? Let's get on with it. Excessive navel-gazing leads to paralysis. At present, it looks as if the entire Republican Party needs to go to counseling. It's really getting embarrassing, all these public professions of feelings of inadequacy. Every day, it seems another jilted, high-placed Republican in Washington is confessing to the voters, "It's not you, it's me." Republican political correctness is all the rage, and it's all roughly the same. We need to stop being conservative. We need to abandon our principles, at least the ones that don't poll well. We need to let the smart guys in Washington pick our candidates. We need big data and analytics so we can optimize. We need to be more libertarian. We need to endorse abortion. We need fewer debates, and the list goes on. The overall level of panic and apology from the operative class in our party is absurd and unmerited. It's time to stop the bedwetting. Let's remember a few things. One, we have 30 governors. Two, we took control of the House in 2010 and we held it in 2012. Three, Obama ran a tremendous campaign in 2008 and our outgoing president was unpopular. Four, the just completed presidential campaign strategy of playing it safe and assuming a poor economy would win it for us was an obvious mistake. How about we take all this energy being spent on autopsies and focus it on painting a picture for the American public, particularly for young people, of what a free and prosperous American future will look like with smart conservative policies? No more self-analysis. We've had our catharsis. The season for navel-gazing is past. Let's stop defeating ourselves, get on offense, and go kick the other guys around. If you followed the news over the past month, they are certainly asking for it. We are the conservative party in America. Deal with it. We have a lot of dissenting voices. So what? Deal with it. The American public waxes and wanes. Fine. It will wax again soon enough. Deal with it and start fighting for our principles instead of against them so we can be in position to create the next wave. At some point, the American public is going to revolt against the nanny state and the leftward march of this president. I don't know when the tipping point will come, but I believe it will come soon. Why? Because the left wants the government to explode, to pay everyone, to hire everyone. They believe that money grows on trees, the earth is flat, the industrial age, factory-style government is a cool new thing. Debts don't have to be repaid. People of faith are ignorant and uneducated. Unborn babies don't matter. Pornography is fine. Traditional marriage is discriminatory. 32-ounce sodas are evil. Red meat should be rationed. Rich people are evil, unless they're from Hollywood or are liberal Democrats. The Israelis are unreasonable. Trans fat must be stopped. Kids trapped in failing school should be patient. Wild weather is a new thing. Moral standards are passé. Government-run health care is high quality. The IRS should violate our constitutional rights. Reporters should be spied upon. Benghazi was handled well. The Second Amendment is outdated, and the first one has some problems, too. Their philosophy does not work, and it got our nation into the mess that it's in. Eventually, Americans will rise up against this new era of big government and this new reign of politically correct terror. In the meantime, Republicans, hold fast, get smarter, get disciplined, get on offense, and put on your big boy pants.
2 minutes and 55 seconds without taking a breath. Kevin is sounding like Bobby Jindal. What do you think of the speech? If he recited it, would it be received as it has in print with Politico? What do you think of Governor Jindal's words, Leo Honeycutt, wordsmith that you are?
Well, you know, I just feel that it's unfortunate. While I agree with much of what he said, it's just the way he said it. And to be honest with you, it's not really his personality. I mean, all of this, a lot of this is adolescent language, and I think it's beneath him.
Well, I wonder, he's got a degree from Brown University. He's a Rhodes Scholar. I've known a few people from Brown University, and most of them don't talk about putting on your big boy pants and going around kicking around the
other guy. Excessive navel-gazing or time to stop bedwetting. I mean, come on.
Who wrote that speech?
I have an idea, but I don't think it was Bobby Jindal.
You don't?
I think he passed it off to somebody else. But this is what you would do if you are a little desperate to get back into the good, well, I can't say the good graces of the GOP, because the way he's been over the last few months with the GOP has not been a very good thing. I mean, I can't imagine you would want to go for the nomination acting like this and saying these things, except that you just want the shock value so that you get national headlines.
But he's talking tough, and Americans generally like politicians who can handle themselves in verbal warfare and maybe even physical warfare. Let's go to Jesse Ventura, who was on this show less than 2 weeks ago, and this is how he described how politicians try to make themselves look perhaps a bit bigger than they are. Well, our governor, Bobby Jindal, he wants to be president, and I'm guessing he's about 5'9 and about 135 pounds. Can a guy like that do it, independent of whether he's qualified?
Sure. You know, they all you got to do is have a presence on television, and they don't need to know how big you are. I mean, on TV cameras and in that controlled environment, they can take a midget and make him a giant.
You worked in television for many years, Leo Honeycutt. Is Jesse right?
Oh, absolutely. You can take enough money and you can package anybody and make them look good. I mean, I know that. You get what do you think? Why do you think Washington, D.C. has gone off the deep end and has cut itself off from the rest of us, people who actually work for a living? I mean, that's what this is really about. I mean, he ends up this piece, Bobby does, talking about how you need to put on your big boy pants. And do what? I mean, become even more polarized? That's old. That's what got us into the problem now. I think that at this point in everybody's lives, we have had enough. I think fanatics on both sides are becoming persona non grata. So, you know, I mean, what is the answer? Here's what I believe is the answer after studying almost all the administrations in Louisiana since Earl Long in the late 50s.
Here's a question from Anthony at LSU. He says, the governor speaks, Governor Jindal, of the Democrats promoting old science and thinking the earth is flat, yet he signed a law in Louisiana allowing science classrooms to use outside materials to teach alternatives to evolution. How long will it take the national media to give him his shellacking on this issue? Writes Anthony.
Well, I think this is a situation where you have somebody who's been in office and been in power for a while, who has insulated himself from the real world as time moved forward, has gotten a bunch of yes men around him who are still watching reruns of West Wing on television, thinking that this is the way you really run it. And I think the pressure is getting to him in sort of the same way that it got to Buddy Romer. You know, Buddy got before the legislature in that last year or two and said, we all need to get together and come together over the campfire and hold hands and sing Kumbaya. And a lot of the legislators were looking at each other like, he's losing his mind.
Well, he was going through a personal crisis then, a divorce, and it might have affected his words. Now, the Governor Jindal, I don't think he's going through any kind of personal crisis. He wants to be president. And he wants to make the right steps to get to a position where he can become president. And so I guess the question now is whether he serves out the next 2.5 years as governor, then runs for president in 2016, or does he run for the U.S. Senate next year against Mary Landrieu and perhaps wait a while. He would have 6 years at the minimum in the U.S. Senate. He could pick his time, and he's only 42, so he would have lots of time. It would seem from a strategic point of view, Leo, that running for the Senate might make sense.
Well, I think if
he wins.
Well, and I think he probably would stand a pretty good... Look, if he could go out of the state this last time and raise $10 million for our governor's race in Louisiana, what do you think he could raise for the U.S. Senate race?
Oh, he can raise money, there's no doubt. But so can Senator Landrieu. There will not be a shortage of funds in this campaign, whether it's Mary Landrieu against Bill Cassidy.
You see, and I think that's what everybody's tired of. We're tired of people buying the office. You know, we need to stop electing politicians who are career with the government and start electing real people. People who actually work for a living, that fight the traffic every day and pay the bills and pay the mortgages and pay the car notes and get their kids in schools and pay the tuition. I mean, you know, come on.
Sounds like you should be writing speeches. But the man you wrote about so well, Edwin Edwards, he never had a shortage of funds when he was running for office, did he?
No, he never did. But, you know, I went over that for 5 years studying this guy, and there's a lot of mistakes that he made. But I will say this, at least he did have a heart that involved compassion for people who needed help. Now, here's the question. Has that help gone from charity to codependency? And I think most people believe that it has.
Well, Edwin Edwards never had Potomac fever. In fact, just the opposite. He got out of Washington as quickly as he could.
He was almost lured back, though, by Ted Kennedy. And if Ted Kennedy had unseated Jimmy Carter, then he would have been VP.
VP?
Yeah.
We would have Eddie and Teddy.
That's right, Eddie and Teddy.
Teddy and Eddie.
Yep.
Two Catholics, two family men.
But one from the north, one from the south.
I don't know if that would have worked, but we'll never know. We'll talk a bit more with Leo Honeycutt and also hear from C.C. Lockwood when we return after this brief timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. Leo Honeycutt with us for a bit longer, the biographer of Edwin Washington Edwards. And we're talking now about Governor Bobby Jindal, who at 42 has been governor now for 6 years. To put it in perspective, Edwin Edwards was a young man when he was elected governor, but he was 44 years old when he was elected. So Bobby Jindal has gotten to the top spot in state government quicker than almost anybody, almost as quick as Huey Long got there. But this governor wants to be president. Edwin Edwards, I think he thought being governor of Louisiana was
enough.
Bigger.
Yeah.
Bigger for him. That was enough. Did that affect the particular governing styles of each?
Well, 144 is all he had to deal with here. Up there, it's 535. You know, plus you've got the national press, too. I mean, if Governor Jindal is sort of afraid of the national press now, imagine what that's going to be like on the campaign trail. I mean, you know, this is not the first time that he has sort of alluded to these kind of things. He just last year, now here he is, the head of the Republican Governors Association. He called the GOP, quote, the party of stupid. I mean, that to me, those are not words or phrases you would use if you were trying to ingratiate yourself into the GOP to get the nomination.
Well, maybe he thinks the nomination's a foregone conclusion, and he's already going for the general electorate.
I don't know if it'd be a foregone. I think it would have been a foregone conclusion maybe 5 or 6 years ago, but I don't think it is now.
Well, he'll have a tough time, let's face it, as will anybody. The odds are against any particular individual becoming president or even getting the nomination of his or her party. But
you see, and that's kind of what I was trying to get to before. The pressure of this office, nobody really knows what that is. The pressure gets to people. I think that the pressure didn't get to Edwin Edwards as badly as it's gotten to everybody else. Look what it did to Kathleen Blanco. Look what it did to Buddy Romer. And now I think what you're seeing in this kind of language and what Governor Jindal has written shows you it's a manifestation of that kind of pressure. You know, all these years of just being surrounded by yes men. I mean, the correspondents down at the Capitol who've been covering politics for all their careers, some down there for 30 years, have never seen anything like this. They're pretty much blackballed out of any press conferences, if, in fact, you can get a press conference. You can never get a direct answer from the governor. You can't get your questions answered. I mean, and then they dare you to ask a question that's not on the script.
Okay. Well, Kevin Gallagher, our producer, goes to those press conferences. He's one of the select few who does. And, Kevin, I'm under the impression that some questions are answered, but it is a limited scope as far as the types of questions. But what is the general feeling when you walk in the room with Governor Jindal and you know he's only going to be there a few minutes and you've got a few questions to ask, and you've got his handlers watching your every move? How is it?
Well, first of all, before the governor comes out, his media people come out and they find out what you want to ask him about. They screen the questions first, much like when you call in this show, we might want to know what you're going to talk about. So they know what the questions are going to be in advance. If you pop a question that you didn't pre-screen, you might hear about it later. And you only get maybe 4 or 5 questions are answered, and then it's all over.
Okay. Well, that's different than it was in quote, the old days. Edwin Edwards used to come out, and I think he enjoyed jousting. He kind of liked it people throw bombshells at him.
He did.
But he was a rare bird.
Well, he got mad a couple of times when Guy Coates, who is the longtime reporter for the Associated Press down there, would tag team with Brenda Hodge from Channel 2, and they were both very, very feisty, and they wouldn't let him off the hook with an easy answer.
That's true. It always helps to have a buddy to help you, because if you're the only person asking tough questions, it can become difficult for the individuals asking the question. But then if somebody follows up and asks one,
right,
and then another person asks
right
one, and that's the way it used to be with Guy Coates,
Brenda
Hodge, and John Hill, and many others in the press corps. I recall Edwards once sending out a press release saying John Hill is, quote, a liar and an ass. And those two became friends.
Yeah, well, but see, that's sort of the way Edwards was. He never held a grudge. I mean, that's the reason why he's 85. He'll be 86 in August. He still is stumping around the state. In fact, he just made a speech yesterday in Ruston.
But why don't the media take it upon themselves to try to break
because
through
the
barriers?
Because you get blackballed.
Well, but
you've
got
so many
if you've got the whole media corps asking questions, you can't blackball the whole media. You can't.
Well, you can just stop having press conferences.
And plus, well, you can do that. That's true. But I don't know of anybody who has been sent to the woodshed permanently by this administration. There's perception that he plays hardball, but I don't know of anybody who's been banned from a press conference.
They've certainly been stifled in what they can ask, and that's not a free press.
All right, and there aren't as many media opportunities as
see that, and I think that's
were
another thing that's working against them here, because most of the guys at the down there are getting on up in age, and they don't want to be in a situation where they can't get something out of the governor's office. So they have to be a little bit conservative and not be quite as boisterous as a lot of us were, you know, 20 years ago.
Well, sure, and that's something I think all media types do. If I have a guest on this show and I treat them in a way that they feel like they're they're being attacked, then they're less likely to come back for a second or third appearance. I try to be nice in the way I ask questions, and sometimes I'm better than I am on other days. But you don't want to close off access permanently to the governor of Louisiana, and that's probably the biggest reason why reporters tread lightly, is that they know they have to deal with this governor for a while longer.
Well, and let's face it, Bobby did come in under the guise that he was going to clean up ethics, and he was going to rewrite Louisiana and the ethics laws, and you know, and then he came under fire from the Ethics Commission itself because they said this was far overreaching. While at the same time, he cloistered the governor's office in more secrecy than any other governor has. I mean, how does that work?
Okay, I think we got time for one call for Leo, and then we'll go to CC Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil, you're on the air with Mr. Honeycutt.
Good morning, Leo. Good morning, Jim.
Hey.
I just have to say, I mean, it's kind of plain as the nose on your face that all these miracle people who start off running for office and end up millionaires miraculously, like, how does that happen? In Washington right now, of the 435 seats or whatever it is, like two-thirds of those people are millionaires, and they didn't all do it the hard way, you know. When people run for office and get millions of dollars in campaign funds, they're encouraged to campaign all the time because that's a budget they can use, mm-hmm. and yet they're running for a $100,000 a year job.
Right.
It's like, you know, and it's like you go to work and the guys that are running out with all of the, you know, the shovels and the picks, they're driving pickup trucks, and the management are sitting in there with their BMWs and Mercedes, and just what, they have a better health plan and pension plan than you do. So it's kind of just the whole, that's what is really fed, you know, made people so cynical about the whole process.
Yeah. And that's been going for a while. I mean, people have just been cynical about the whole thing for a while. There's a lot of voter apathy out there for a good reason, because Washington's out of touch, to a degree Baton Rouge is out of touch, and people are tired of it. People who work for a living are tired of it.
Is Edwin Edwards a rich man?
If he is, I guess he must be going to carry it with him to the grave, because I haven't seen it. I mean, I joked with him one time when he was in prison. I said, look, why don't you just tell me where it is? And, you know, if you die in here, who's going to know? And he says, Leo, if I had it, I wouldn't tell you.
And he's about to become a father at 86.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, hard to believe.
Not 8 years from the Guinness Book of Records.
Really?
Yeah, 94 is the record for a father. But he commented the other day at a restaurant owned by the publisher of the Baton Rouge Advocate that that he may have the record because his oldest daughter is 63, soon to be 64, and he'll be a, you know, newborn kid. So almost 64 years between oldest and youngest. He says, I bet that's a record.
And I'll bet it is a record. I bet it is. But, you know, to go back to what the caller was calling about just a second ago, 60 Minutes just 2 years ago did a study of what he just talked about. And he talked about how a lot of the people who go into Congress, their assets barely make more than $300,000 or $400,000 when they go into office, and somehow, miraculously, when they come out, they're worth about $2 million.
Yeah, it happens. And for years, up until last year, congressmen and women, congresswomen, they could do legal insider trading.
Yeah.
So there are some advantages to being a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. So maybe,
you know, I feel for Bobby. I really do. We've been friends ever since he was in his 20s when Mike Foster discovered him, and I think that he has always meant well. I think he's idealistic, but I do think that, you know, it's been tough, and I think that what you're seeing now is a manifestation of that pressure.
But he has many years to create a new reality for himself and for his supporters, and perhaps even convince some of his detractors. He's only 42, and perhaps next year, at the age of 43, he will be running for the United States
Senate. You know, it might do him well if he just set out for about 5 years and just kind of raised a family.
Well, I think he's addicted to politics, and so is Mary Landrieu, for that matter.
Well, that's true, but I think she's about ready to retire.
33 of the last 34 years she's been in office, and she's running for another 6 years. And we're joined now by C.C. Lockwood, who's been addicted to photography for over 40 years. He's been in the wilderness all over the world, in the swamps and the marshes of Louisiana. And tomorrow at 2 o'clock at the Manship Theater, C.C. will be on hand exploring the world of nature and his profession in a discussion about a move to digital photography. Now, how does a guy who's out in the marshes do it digitally? Have you made the transition seamlessly, CeCe?
Well, I moved into it slowly, and I just waited for the equipment to catch up with the quality that the Kodachrome and the Fuji Velvia transparencies had. And it crossed that barrier about 6 years ago, and it's a really brave new world with all the new equipment, the fast changing pace in the computer programs, and the size of the file of each picture, and also in the market. So it's a whole different way for a young man to start out to be a nature photographer, such way different than mine.
Are the photographs as good?
They are. I'd say they're better now with the newest model I just got. The Nikon D800 is 34 megapixels, and it can, I'm pretty sure I could make one larger than I ever made with a print.
You've published 13 books. You say it's better than ever. So as significant as your photographs have been over the last four decades, your best work may be ahead.
It really could be, and I'm finally starting a new book, and I'm also the general public. Everybody has a camera. Everybody's taking pictures, and they're all starving for knowledge. And you know, I've taught the workshops with the field trip into the Chaffalaya for 40 years, but I'm going to start doing more such as this at the Manship, where we just really get down to the nuts and bolts of how to process and take care of the photographs you get with that great new digital camera.
CC now uses Photoshop instead of a dark room with chemicals and memory cards instead of film. I would imagine it's much easier now, isn't it?
Well, you know, I used to go on a two-week trip with 100, 120 rolls of film and about 20 to 40 AA batteries. And now I go with about six chips and a bunch of charging cords I usually carry seven extra batteries for my digital camera. So if you weight each pile, it's probably about the same. But the lenses and things are getting so much better that I carry a few less lenses than I used to. So I am traveling a little lighter.
Yes, you still have to pick your shots, though.
Oh, yeah. And one of the more clerical side of it is, once you buy the Photoshop and the camera and the chips and the batteries, every little push of the shutter is almost free, except for the time of processing, editing when you get back to the computer. So you shoot a little more, I found, with these chips, because you just erase them and start over once you put it on your hard drive.
Is it less expensive as a whole or more?
I would, you know, the new cameras are, they go up so much as each new model because they have so much technology in them. I think between the computer programs you have to replace and the cameras, you probably spend more than you used to on film.
More?
I think so.
All right. Well, you know, the Internet has done some remarkable things, good and bad, and now many people don't write letters anymore, but... How is the technology affecting photography as a whole? Is there a tendency to get complacent now?
I think, I'm showing a little cartoon in my slideshow tomorrow with a guy holding a film camera and saying, oh, I've got my baby pictures and my high school graduation on this roll of film. And then the right side of the frame has him look at 32 pictures of my lunch on my phone. So everybody takes a lot of pictures today, and they need to learn how to take care of them, get rid of the bad ones, and process and catalog the good ones so they could find them and share them with their friends and family. And if they want to be a professional, that's more important too.
Yeah, well, in the old days when you got a good shot, you'd guard it with your life. I suspect a lot of them now get deleted.
You've got to learn to delete the bad ones immediately and back up the good ones in a safe place and then keep the real good ones right in front of you that you're going to use, you know, particularly if you're professional, that you have to get those off to magazines and clients and things.
Well, tomorrow
it's erased. It's, it's just like this pixel's gone.
You'll be giving a seminar of sorts, and the first part of the program will educate us on what's in a great picture, perhaps inspire our creative juices, and then CC will continue with the use of Adobe Photoshop and Lightroom to process and organize images. And there is a cost for this seminar, 2 to 5 at the Manship Theater, right?
At the Manship Theater, and it's just a thrill for me, who could never sing a note, that I'll be showing my pictures with the likes of Jesse Winchester and Beaujolais, and people like that have put on great concerts. And I'd also like to mention that the Louisiana Photographic Society and myself and Steve Uffman are going to have an exhibit up after the show, and it'll stay in the Manship Gallery for about 30 days.
2 to 5 tomorrow in the afternoon, CC, Manship Theater. Until tomorrow, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.